We'll go to our film reviews now. Up for consideration, Terminator Dark Fate. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Linda Hamilton reunite to help save the world. Again, The Addams Family, newly animated version of the TV classic, and By the Grace of God, French film about the cover-up of clerical child abuse by the Catholic Church in France. The cover-up by the Catholic Church, that is. I'm joined in studio now by Ruth Barton and Daryl Jones. Let's start with Terminator Dark Fate. It's the sixth in the Terminator series, this one, Ruth. But really, this is a sequel to Terminator 2. Would we be as well off just to forget about the three that came in between in some ways?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the last one had the even just terrible name of Terminator Genesis, which was spelt with this kind of horrible, you know, it's Genesis S-Y-S at the end, just to be, you know, funny. And that's probably the most interesting thing about that film. So let's do total mind wipe with those and bring ourselves back to the heady days of the original two Terminator films, 1 and 2.
And I guess Sarah Connor and Arnie playing Terminator, the original Terminator, were essential to those two movies, Daryl.
Yes, and they're back, and you know, I for one, was very glad to spend more time in their company. So Linda Hamilton is back as Sarah Connor, who looks, sounds, acts, and behaves as though she has spent, you know, her entire adult life fighting monsters, and is great.
Which is what the character says she's been doing.
That's absolutely right. Arnie is in the same way that he was in Terminator 2, you know, often quite funny, sometimes strangely affecting. He has all the best lines.
He also has a kind of a nice badger-like grey beard. He's looking very, very old, but in a good way.
Grizzled is what he's looking. I think we learned in one of the older, one of the previous Terminator films that Terminator's flesh is human flesh, so it ages with the Terminators. And he's been living a kind of suburban lifestyle in Laredo, Texas. He's married. He's called Carl, and he's in the drapery business.
He's a draper.
He is.
Okay. Right. Well, let's have a listen to... there is one other character we need to know about here. And this is Grace. I suppose we kind of need to know the setup to realise who Grace is. Ruth.
Grace arrives in a flash of light, totally naked on a highway at the opening of the film. And she is the kind of new Sarah Connor figure. So she has been sent from the future back into the present in order to save a young woman called Dani, who, if she can save her, they can then replay time and save the world.
Right. Okay. So it's all the save the world thing by replaying time, but the important
thing
is
saving a woman.
Yeah, and save the woman in order to do that. So here's the scene where Sarah Connor, played by Linda Hamilton, and Grace, played by Mackenzie Davis, kind of introduce themselves to each other. It's more kind of Sarah Connor saying who she is.
My name is Sarah Connor. August 29, 1997. It was supposed to be Judgment Day. But I changed the future. Saved 3 billion lives. Enough of a resume for you?
No.
You may have changed the future, but you didn't change our fate.
Oh, yes, you have to save the world several times, or there would never be an action movie, really, if you didn't have to, would there? That's Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, Mackenzie Davis as Grace in that clip from Terminator Dark Fate. I suppose the thing about the Terminator films is, are they both funny, and can you kind of buy into the premise, Daryl?
I think you can. And, you know, I speak as somebody who's been a great admirer of the franchise since the beginning. You know, I remember watching the first Terminator movie when it came out in the mid-80s and being completely captivated by it. And I think Dark Fate has all the things that one would want from watching a Terminator movie. In some ways, it simply revisits a lot of the old films. So there's an element of greatest hits going on about this one. I think the plot is very similar to Terminator 2.
Yeah, and part of the issue here is, I suppose, Terminator fans will know this, but there's a score to be settled between Sarah Connor and Arnie's character, who we can just call Terminator. Or in the case of this program, in this case of this film, what's he called? Did you say?
He's called Carl.
Carl.
Let's just call him Arnie because he's the ex-governor of California, who is better known as a sort of dryly funny film star.
Yeah, Arnie.
He's Arnie. Yes, and he's Arnie in this film. He's absolutely nothing else. Because Arnie killed Sarah Connor's son John.
Yeah, so
and we see that we're reminded of that, lest we should have forgotten.
Yeah, or that if you hadn't seen it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They also have to spar off each other, and then they have to be reliant on each other. That's part of the film's.
Yeah, and distinguished, by the way, was the word which you both helped me find that I was looking for in terms of Arnie and his grey beard. Is the kind of elder statesman thing sitting well on his shoulders?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was interested because I had actually been really looking forward to how they'd aged Linda Hamilton. I was looking forward to seeing how they de-aged her, because seeing women of her, she's 68 in real life, seeing a woman of that age on screen who can still kick ass is quite unusual. And I was looking forward to it, and I thought they really, really delivered on it. The only trouble is the good lines go to Arnie, and there's a very, very funny exchange between them where he explains how he became the father to this family, sort of part of familias figure, and how they love him, and for his dry wit, and because everybody falls apart because he isn't funny, right? and then he also says in another line, "I won't be back," and we all know that's hilariously funny because he one of the catch lines that everybody remembers from the movies.
We do hear "I'll be back," and we won't say how, but we do hear it from another character. And that in itself, I thought, was quite a gift to give to another actor. And what about then other performances around him? And I suppose in particular Linda Hamilton, who you've already praised quite highly, Darrell.
She's great. As Ruth said, this is most definitely a performance by a woman in late middle age. Mm. There's no doubt about that. She's not been altered.
Yeah.
In any way, but she looks fantastic, and she is fantastic, and she's counterpointed with Mackenzie Davis as this kind of badass woman warrior from the future who's been augmented, who is herself a kind of cyborg, a kind of Terminator,
and says she's human.
And she is.
Which must be going to become part of another storyline, really.
Insists that she is, in fact, human. And, as we know, with the multiple overlapping, contradicting timelines of all of these films, nothing is ever to be taken for granted here. People can be simultaneously alive and dead, or come back from the dead. But she is, I think Mackenzie Davis is fantastic. She has, extraordinary presence, I think.
And I suppose, is it Gabriel Luna who plays the new Terminator here, a new type of Terminator, Rev 9.
He is just so uninteresting. The film is not interested in him at all. It's interested in the three central women. Mm.
Woman then is Natalia Reyes. Is that it? She's playing...
Yeah, she plays Dani. She's
who has to be saved in order to save the world.
But for actually a really good reason. There's a really nice play on our expectations of why she should be saved and why she is to be saved.
Briefly,
which I won't give away.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. And this is... Her story is set in and around Mexico. Is that...
It's on the border. And of course, the film does play with
gives it a type of prescience, does it?
It does, because they're trying to escape across the border. There are all these trains of people trying to escape across, and then they're caged when they get there.
Ah, right. So speaking directly to the present moment in many ways. Stars out of 5 from you, Darrell.
I thought it was the best Terminator film, certainly since Terminator 3. I liked it a lot. So 4.
4 from you. And Ruth?
Slightly less enthusiastic, 3.5.
4 and 3.5. Best since Terminator 3 or Terminator 2, did you mean?
Maybe the best since Terminator 2, yeah.
Okay, all right. Let's move on then to the Addams Family. Now, there's been a TV series, I don't know how long that TV series ran for, but it was very popular. There have been 2 films. And now we have an animated version of the original New Yorker comic strip, where the whole thing started out, obviously. So, What do we need? How ordinary are the Addams Family? Let me lead you with that question, Darrell.
In some ways, they're a completely normal, stable, loving nuclear family, and that's part of the joke. And in other ways, they're completely ghoulish, yeah. And they move to suburban New Jersey, albeit an abandoned lunatic asylum in suburban New Jersey, from the unspecified old country that, you know, the torch wielding, pitchfork wielding natives have run them out of, and become an American family.
And I suppose to describe them as that is the joke of it all. But they could.
That's always been the joke.
The goth quality, particularly of the teenage guys, and Wednesday is the teenager here. It kind of fits in maybe to the behaviour of if we give a kind of a classic version of a teenager.
Yeah, she is, and by far the most interesting, and that's really stretching a point, part of this film, is the kind of high school movie subplot. So the film is generically a mashup, and the only interesting part is when Wednesday, who's voiced by Chloe Grace Moritz, decides she wants to go to school, which is, you know, the family takes fairly well, though they wouldn't have normally recommended that.
They're in New Jersey, aren't they?
Yeah. But they're also they're beside this kind of super pastel coloured town called Joke Assimilation. And so she goes to the super pastel town and she goes to this very ordinary school, but of course she becomes friends with the outsider girl in the school. And the outsider girl is being bullied, and she then is able to turn the tables on the bullies and to provide some rather nasty magic to get.
I suppose I want to listen to a clip that features the whole family, as it were, here. So Morticia, who's the mammy of the family, Charlize Theron, Gomez is the daddy of the family, Oscar Isaac, Wednesday, the young teenage child that we've been speaking to there, Chloe Grace Moretz, and her younger brother, Pugsley, played by Finn Wolfhard. Now, they're about to sit down for dinner, and Uncle Fester, of course, is around them. I'm sure Lurch appears at some point here to serve dinner as well. But anyway, Uncle Fester, played by Nick Kroll, is there. You'll hear all of those voices within this 35 seconds, believe it or not.
Wednesday, please, no ink stains on the table.
Yes, Mother.
Gomez, everyone we've invited to the mazurka has threatened to come.
I know, isn't it wonderful? All Adamses under one roof again.
Yes, but where will everyone sleep?
We'll have Lurch fix up the mausoleum. It'll be like sleepaway camp.
Very well, darling.
Uncle Fester!
Brother! Don't worry, I'm okay. The plate glass window broke my fall.
There you go. A selection of characters from the Addams Family, which when I'm listening to the voicing of it and when I read those names, Charlize Theron, Oscar Isaac, Chloe Grace Moretz, Finn Wolfhard, Nick Kroll, it's hardly surprising that the voicing is good, Ruth.
Oh, they have incredible voice actors playing the parts. And actually, that sequence that you played illustrates one of the real problems of the film, because they're trying to cram in so many characters and so many different plot lines. It's quite a short film, it's only 19 minutes long, that they can never develop anything. You can never really get into the characters and follow any kind of character arc, and you don't any of these kind of minor plot lines that evolve never get followed through. So that high school movie plot line just stops, it just holds.
Yeah, and that high school movie plot line is that's Alison Janney plays the mother of the bullied girl, yeah?
Yeah, and she's she's a real estate agent, and she's trying to do a reality TV show in order to sell more properties in the chintzy town.
And I guess this is where the Addams Family can play on this idea that the Alison Janney character and her daughter, as the ordinary people, are in fact a lot more weird than the so-called weird Addams Family. That's the classic thing that they do.
That is, and you know, this is in some ways then a very, very conservative and a very, very straightforward film. And you know, it's one of these films which, you know, the lesson that it gives us: just be yourself, you know. But also the you know, I'm kind of fed up of films from the culture industry telling me about the virtue of individuality and being original when they are not themselves, you know.
And was that the case with this film?
It was. Look, I mean, as I said, it's got Alison Janney in it. There's no such thing as an altogether bad film with Alison Janney in it, and it has a wonderful cast. And you know,
it's an animated film. How does it look?
Well, I thought it looked okay. You know, it has a kind of gothy CGI aesthetic that's heavily influenced, I think, by Tim Burton. But that's okay because Burton himself was heavily influenced by Charles Adams. So it does
the original cartoon,
the original cartoonist of the Adams family. It doesn't look bad at all. It's just not memorable. I don't think.
Are you in the same boat on that one, Ruth?
Yeah, I find it very very flat. I mean, I think we've moved on so much too with animation, a Toy Story and all those incredible animated films, that this to me looked just flat. There aren't any very good visual gags in the animation. It's so reliant on story, but as you're saying, it's just so predictable as well, good versus bad. And I mean, I was interested, you're mentioning Tim Burton, and I thought, Edward Scissorhands, I thought, where the Avon lady comes out of the pastel town into the haunted castle, finds this abandoned boy and then integrates him, and he becomes caught up in the pastel town. And I thought, this film is sort of could have been really nicely playing with that, and I think it was. But it just falls so flat. I'm not certain.
And is that one of these plot threads that it dangles something in front of you and then it just doesn't develop it?
Yeah, and then it's also got this minor plot thread about Alison Janney's character, who has a very nasty kind of undercover existence, and she's a voyeur that is the film's kind of big reveal at the end. But by the end, who cares, really? And also, what I also minded was even the musical numbers were very flat. And there isn't a great. Of course, you have the finger clicking. You know, the finger clicking that we all remember.
Wrong with that. Yeah.
But aside from that, love it.
Yeah. You want to do it immediately, don't you?
But again, outside of that, nothing to sing along with.
And a particularly well or badly judged joke around,
Uncle Fester. There's a very unwise running joke about Uncle Fester being a sex offender. And it keeps returning to this joke.
In 2019.
Exactly. And I was trying to remember, was Jackie Coogan, was his Uncle Fester a sex offender in the 1960s? Was that okay? Maybe it was funny back then,
Not now.
But he, in turn, finds love with Alison Janney's voyeuristic Margot, who I should also say has a fantastic Donald Trump hairstyle. So there's no getting away from cinematic Donald Trumps, I don't think. But it just kept reminding me of films that it resembled but were better, or things that it resembled but were better. Edward Scissorhands being one, The Truman Show being another. There's a whole lot of Heathers, a whole lot of films that it's sort of like but not as good.
Not nearly as good. And briefly, Snoop Dogg gets an appearance. Snoop Dogg's voice gets an appearance.
Yeah, but don't hold your breath. He gets two lines and a lot more promotion than is certainly is
right,
it's,
yeah,
it's
so
worth.
Maybe they planned for there to be more. But
I think he must have got caught. I mean, it is quite a short film, and that is perhaps the best thing I can say about it.
Okay. How good is it in terms of stars then? Adams Family animated version.
I gave it a generous 2.5.
Generous 2.5?
Yeah, 2.5.
2.5, okay. You're both in total accord on that one. Let's move on then to our final film up for consideration this evening. By the grace of God, we spoke to the director, Francois Ozon, on the show earlier this week. Ruth, we're talking about a true story here in the case of By the Grace of God. Just give us the outlay of what the basic plot is here.
The plot, as you say, it is a true story. It's about the church's cover-up of clerical sexual abuse. It's set in the present. It moves from one story to another story to another story. So it follows three different people who are survivors of abuse. Mm. The first is Alexandre Guérin, who is a father of five children. He has a lovely kind of French, very sort of French film lifestyle, very middle class.
Devout Catholic.
A devout Catholic. He attends mass, every week.
And despite the fact that he was abused as a child.
And he's, of course, he suppressed this. Mm. But he decides that he's going to confront the church, and he starts writing this series of letters to the cardinal. And so the film, to me, started off quite slowly because there's a lot of voiceover and exposition. Mm. It then moves up a gear into and really kind of finds its pace, I think, when he airs his story and a second survivor comes up. Emerges, and he's this kind of huge bear-like character.
Is this the character of Francois?
Yes, it is.
Played by
Dennis Minoche.
Yeah,
and so he's very charismatic, and he really eats up the screen. And so he then goes to social media. He decides to take hold of his story, and then other people come forward. And the third character then that we get introduced to is this figure called, he's Emmanuel. And he's this very fragile, very emotionally fragile, real kind of victim who is himself, you know, you can't like him. He smacks his wife around, his partner around.
The damage
so
is
damaged.
Very evident.
Yeah. And you're always, but you're also always afraid for him because he's epileptic and he rides a motorbike. And there's a sequence you think, uh-oh. And so the story hinges around these three. It weaves between them and also the real issue is the statute of limitations, because they are too late to bring the abuser to justice. The story it's gone on for too long. It's too long since it happened. Rather.
Yeah, the abuser in question here is Bernard Prena, and the other person who's involved in the cover up or very close to the cover up is Cardinal Barbaram. How does Ozon handle the telling of the story, the part played by the Catholic Church, particularly the hierarchy in the cover up? Daryl?
Well, for obvious reasons, the church comes out of the film very badly. But the thing that surprised me, when viewing it, was that there is no or very little denial in the film. Mm. Everybody acknowledges, the priest acknowledges that, yes, indeed, he was an abuser of children.
And says that he told the hierarchy and that they ignored him.
That's absolutely right. The cardinal says, yes, this is monstrous, this is terrible, this should never have happened, I'm terribly sorry, something will be done about this. But nothing is ever done. So this is a kind of placatory gesture that happens time and again. It seems when Alexandre first goes to the church, he has an interview with a person who seems, I mean, you're not quite sure what she is at first, a very sympathetic seeming woman who may be a social worker or a therapist of some kind, but who turns out to be the cardinal's assistant and is you know complicit through silence, I suppose,
conflict of interest
very strongly.
The other thing that struck me that I think is worth talking about here is the fact Ozon, what type of movie would we associate with Francois Ozon as opposed to this docudrama that we get?
This is so out of character with Ozon's cinema. Ozon makes these witty films, usually centred around women, sophisticated French comedies of manners. And suddenly he has turned around and he has made this film. And you've spoken to him, but he started off going to make a documentary, which he's also not a documentary filmmaker. So he then switches the film into this, I guess, docudrama. And you know, as I say, at the beginning, you think, oh, okay, it kind of is an Ozon film because he's got this sort of quite sophisticated background. But then it just turns into something completely different. And I mean, I really admire him for dropping his kind of filmmaking that we'd expect from him and doing this.
And the film was almost banned in the process of making it. What was the problem there?
That's right. So it's based on a true story, and the abusive priest, Bernard Prena, his lawyers tried to ban. Tried to block the film's release
on the grounds that this was prejudged.
That this was an ongoing court case, but since the verdict was, or the decision was, that since he'd already pled guilty, there was no ambiguity as to his role as an abuser, so the film was allowed a release consequently.
Now, the film is called By the Grace of God, and we hear the cardinal, Cardinal Barbaram, played by Francois Martinet, is it? Marture, he plays the character of the cardinal, and he says, by the grace of God, the statutes of limitation has passed. In a live situation, in a press conference. I asked Francois Ozon about this, because the man is so measured, Cardinal Barbaram, why do you think he uttered those words in the midst of a press conference? I mean, they're so offensive.
They're so offensive, and for me, it speaks to his absolute superiority, or his sense of his own invincibility and his sense of his own righteousness as well as rightness, because he has been ordained by God to be the Pope, I guess, God, but you know, to stand in for God in this, it's Lyon. And so therefore, God has sanctioned what he's doing and he has to be right.
Yeah, I thought Ozon was particularly generous when he said he thought it was kind of a Freudian slip on the part of the cardinal. Are you with Ozon on it?
That's kind of how I thought of it as being was a kind of Freudian slip, or at least a kind of slip. Yes.
No, I don't think anybody will doubt the rightness of telling this story, but does it work as a film, Daryl?
I thought so. I thought its structure, its kind of tripartite structure, was very effective. It has moments of humour. It has moments of warmth. So it's not the harrowing experience that I was expecting.
And stars?
Four.
And what are you saying, Ruth, overall?
Yeah, I gave it 4.5. I thought it was, I mean, apart from some slight structural fragility, I thought it was brave, and I thought it was very, very compelling. I was really caught up with it.
All right, Ruth Barton and Daryl Jones are speaking to us about the third film, By the Grace of God, which is on limited release, whereas the other two we spoke about, Terminator Dark Fate and The Addams Family, both on general release.